I have another set of notes here for the materials, so there may be some overlapping or things that will not perfectly fit into what we saw the last time. I believe, unless I'm mistaken, we had been talking about how to assist more profitably with Mass. I'm not sure we finished it. Would you say we did?
Mm-hmm. But we didn't finish from the time before on mental prayer.
In other words, how to teach mental prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Who remembers where we got on that one?
We just barely started.
We just began it, eh? Well, let's begin again then. So we're back to section 13, number 2, how to teach mental prayer. It might be valuable, before we get into the subject of mental prayer proper, to address ourselves to the nature of prayer, the types and what I call forms of prayer, and then zero in on mental prayer in particular. Over the years, I have found the simplest definition of prayer that covers every possible form is to say that prayer is the voluntary response to the awareness of God's presence. There must then first be a mental awareness of God's presence. He is present, whether I'm aware of it or not. But I begin to pray when I am aware of His presence. All prayer, therefore, begins in the mind. Assuming that awareness of God's presence is not yet prayer, I must somehow respond to that presence. And I do so freely and voluntarily, depending on how freely or generously I respond to that awareness, I am more or less intensely praying. Now, the two general types. We commonly distinguish between vocal and mental prayer, where by vocal prayer we understand that prayer in which I use someone else's words and not my own. They may be the words of Scripture, the words of Christ, the words of the Church, or simply of someone else than myself. When I use those words, I am said to be praying vocally, whether I am literally vocalizing or not. Mental prayer, as distinct from vocal, is where the words or the expression in the prayer is of my own making. And then we distinguish within mental prayer meditation and contemplation, which I have found it convenient to say that in meditation, the mental prayer is a prayer of reasoning. In contemplation, it is a prayer of looking. When I meditate, I am reflecting. I am thinking out, thinking through, analyzing. When I am contemplating, I am, as it were, done with the meditation, and I now dwell on the fruit of my meditation. In Latin, we distinguish between the two forms of prayer by saying that while the mind is used both in meditation and in contemplation, the faculty of the mind, which is used in meditation, is the ratio, the reason, whereas in contemplation, the faculty of the mind which is used is intellectus. You might roughly say reason and intelligence, but the vocabulary in English isn't much help. The Latin is very clear. Ratio means I am still working towards the grasp of the truth. Once I have the truth and I behold it, I look at it, I steep myself in it, I, as it were, lose myself in it. That is contemplation. I still want to note the two principal forms of prayer. They can be, that is, our prayers can be either private or liturgical. I suppose the simplest description of private prayer is that it's not liturgical. It is said either alone, in privacy, and or especially, it is that form of prayer which has not become the church's official prayer. Liturgical prayer, and this is the simplest definition, the official public prayer of the church, where the three operative words in liturgical prayer are official, public, and of the church. With that as a sort of backdrop, let's now look at mental prayer proper. What are some of the basic needs that in teaching or training people for mental prayer should be brought to their attention, and that if it is our responsibility to teach them, to make sure they learn? The first basic need for all prayer, and especially for mental prayer, is a deep faith. Is there a special need for deep faith in mental prayer, more so than in vocal prayer? I think so. Why? Because in vocal prayer, the person may be praying and vocalizing, or at least expressing him or herself in words, and feel quite satisfied, even though the faith is not all that active. But in mental prayer, either your faith is operative or you're not praying. Moreover, the deeper the faith, the more intense the mental prayer. Secondly, we're talking about basic needs. Memory. Memory is an indispensable element in the practice and development of mental prayer. Why is that true? Because unless I have on my mind, and before I begin to pray, certain things on which I am to reflect, whether in reasoning or in contemplative fashion, notice, mental prayer spans both, well, it'll be a constant struggle to even keep something religious or spiritual on my mind. In other words, the memory must be fairly well stocked with available material on which to meditate or about which to contemplate. It is a good idea, and St. Ignatius thinks it is indispensable, to not trust to one's passive memory when beginning mental prayer. but to make sure to remind oneself of what may already be on the mind in order to bring to the surface some particular aspect of what I wish to meditate on or contemplate about, drawing on things that are already part of my deposit of faith. This is one reason that I think it is a good idea early in the religious life to encourage and even to get the religious into the practice of memorizing. I think I told you from the time that I began teaching the Missionaries of Charity in the Bronx, I can't imagine how much they've memorized. All I know is it's a lot in 4 years. It used to be every week for the first 2 years. They began to complain to the superior, this is too much. So I was asked, could I cut down to the amount of memory? So I said, all right. So it's now every 2 weeks. And right after prayer, they all have their half sheets of paper, and it usually takes about this much. Every 2 weeks, they write out this much of the scriptures. Well, 40 to 50 times a year, as it used to be for 2 years, 100 half sheets, and now another 100 half sheets. That's 200 they have memorized. I'm not sure how much they remember still. And these are the postulants and novices. What things are simply good to memorize? And younger people often have very retentive memories. Nature seems to bless younger people with good memories. As we get older, the Lord, in His mercy, enables us to forget. It's a special gift of advanced years. And it's just as well. I call it selective memory, where you forget certain things, and in God's providence, I've discovered those are the things I should have forgotten in the first place. So cultivate the memory. I consider this part of the spiritual life. So, like what? First and most obviously, the scriptures. It shouldn't be indiscriminate, should be itself selective, but don't hesitate burdening the memory. The human psyche is so arranged, it will never remember more than it can retain. Just one observation. The most important single factor in memorizing is the will. What we want to remember, we remember. What we want to forget, it's remarkable how conveniently we forget. Then, some of the basic prayers of the church. I'm told a lot of young people coming into religious life don't even know some of the basics of, you might say, ordinary Catholic living. So prayers, both those for private and liturgical recitation, should be memorized. And the beauty of this is, it gives you a disciplinary tool for early training, which is invaluable. There are certain things that are simply expected. Then, certain facts of the church's history, it is good to memorize. For example, the dates. I think every novice should have at least 50, I would suggest 100 Catholic dates in his or her memory. The great events of the church's history. May I ask, brother, when did the Second Vatican Council open?
Was it June of 1963?
It opened in 1960?
Two.
Well, October. Really, in October, but at least 1962. When was Pope John Paul II elected? Sister Linda, what year?
Year 1978 or 9, 8.
Eight. Would you even possibly remember the day?
October
the 16th. Isn't it a fact that in secular matters, our memories are just cluttered with facts? Some of the biblical figures should be known, who they are. Where, for example, Abraham came from. Where did Abraham come from? All right. Of what? Of what nation of people?
The Chaldeans.
Chaldeans. Well, all I'm saying is, doesn't this make sense?
Yeah.
And people can go through their religious life 40, 50 years and not know some of the basics, as I would call them, of the history of salvation. For example, I have discovered, and I used to do this until I felt I was embarrassing the religious too much. Whenever I'd start teaching a class of religious, say novices, one of my first memory exercises, without announcing it beforehand, I would ask them to give me the names of the 12 apostles. Do you know, out of 30 or 40, I was lucky to get one or two that had every one of them? It's remarkable. Especially when you get into the refinements, like Simon, or Nathaniel, or Thaddeus, and they repeat the same man under a different title twice, and miss one of the apostles in the process. So memory. And the beauty of this is that the effort expended in memorizing these, you might call them, essentials of our faith is pleasing to God, and the beauty is that then the mind is going around with a manual of meditation. All you need is your mind.
You know, Father, I think that's so important that you should stress that, because in that document on the catechesis by John Paul, he emphasized so much the importance of memorization and the instruction of catechesis.
Yes. And so certain articles of the faith, the answers to certain questions. I have turned in, I think, since our last class, the manuscript of the Question and Answer Catechism to the publisher. And we're going to take certain parts today, because we're going to be on penance, I hope, in our class on the sacraments. Clear, simple, concise expressions of our faith. Because if I cannot, for example, define something in which I believe, my meditation can be very vague, very confused, because my mind is not clear what I'm meditating on.
Would you not say, Father, that your spiritual reading is the most important part of the foundation for any kind of prayer?
Well, I'd say it is important.
Insofar as that, I would think that if you don't do your reading, that you're not praying.
I would distinguish. I think in general you are right, and we're going to talk about spiritual reading, but people differ immensely. And I'm thinking of my mother, who was just a master in mental prayer. Practically never read anything through a sixth grade education. She just was not academically inclined. So it is true that during the day, the mind should somehow be directed towards or nourished by spiritual thoughts. I think in a literary culture like ours, reading is the ordinary nourishment, spiritual reading. You're right. Especially, I would say this, spiritual reading is indispensable for those who do a fair amount of secular reading. Otherwise, their minds are going to be so filled with secular thoughts that spiritual thoughts, even when they sit down or kneel down to pray, it'll take them so long to collect their thoughts, to get into God's presence. So in general, you are right.
Could I just also say this? Would you not also say that St. Ignatius, when he refers to mental prayer and contemplation, he has the same thing in mind, insofar as that he is lifting his he develops the picture and works from there.
Well, yes, except we can theologically, and we should distinguish between the one process and the other. Remember, too, with Ignatius or any of the great spiritual masters, they move so quickly from one to the other, first of all, because of who they are, and secondly, in any given, say, hour of prayer, mental prayer, we could hardly say, I am now meditating, and then now I'm beginning to contemplate. Now, for Ignatius, to make sure that no period of mental prayer would ever remain merely meditation, but become also contemplative, he provided what he called the colloquy, where I engage in conversation with God or Our Lady or someone, where the assumption is I am mentally looking at Christ, addressing myself to him, and no longer reasoning or engaging in what is called discursive reflection.
Yes.
And then he would say, if you find fruit at any stage in what he might call meditation, don't continue your reflections or your analytic reasoning, but just stay there. But for our purpose, we had better distinguish between the two, because the one is not the other. And there are some people, and this is also good to hear, there are some people, and even saints, compare two men, both great saints in the church's calendar, John of the Cross and Vincent de Paul. You cannot imagine two men whose form of mental prayer was more different. For John of the Cross, it was, I would say, always contemplative. I don't believe there were two consecutive sentences of reasoning in John of the Cross. He's always looking at God, looking at Christ, beholding the mysteries of the faith, and just thrilled with what he sees and shares with you his vision. Please?
A gift of contemplation. That's a gift from God.
Yes. It's, and you can work at it, but it must be given. Vincent de Paul, I don't remember two consecutive sentences of what I would call mystical contemplation in Vincent de Paul. His conferences to his religious and his own prayer life. He was always thinking, always planning. He was talking to God about, well, the poor people that he was going to take care of. Lord, what can I do? How can I improve my work? We've got problems. Lord, help me to solve them. So it is important, lest we get the idea, which would be mistaken, that we are not praying as well as we might because we are not always on the contemplative level. And this is where I think I mentioned that in our own novitiate we were forbidden by the novice master to read John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, except with special permission. As I look back, I might say to myself, I know we thought then, gosh, we're being deprived of some of the treasury of the church. Well, we weren't told never to read them, but we had to get the book from the novice master. He'd give it to us. And he told us more than once. In other words, I'm reflecting my Ignatian training, that you start the young religious on the Counsels of Teresa or the Commentary on the Canticle of Canticles of John of the Cross. And these poor dears are just not mystics. And they can find dry, insipid, tasteless, and worst of all, useless, the down-to-earth prayer of Alfonso de Liguori, Lord, make haste to help me. I'm in trouble. Then for the next hour, you tell God about your troubles. And having dealt in dealing with some very saintly souls, all I know is they are not all contemplatives. So, yes, mental prayer is both, and the distinction, though it may seem theologically subtle, I think is very practically important. Any other comments?
I can think about this shared prayer. The shared prayer, you know, for instance, okay, you read the piece of scriptures and then you share it with somebody else, you know.
Well, shared prayer, first of all, would not be in our technical sense mental prayer,
no.
Except I suppose if it is spontaneous shared prayer. Well, let me make two observations. First of all, personally, it does not appeal to me.
Me neither, but there is some people that they really wish for, you know.
Shared prayer, as such, I think, for certain people, can be legitimate. The problem, however, now with shared prayer is that it has become, in fact, a synonym for Pentecostal and charismatic prayer. And as I think I've quoted to you, Mother Teresa, when some of her sisters were Pentecostals, in New York, And I went, well, I happened to be in Rome on business at the time. She was there. And you tell the superior back home, I want no active charismatics in my community. I think the Lord has given me a special charism in every country where these people enter the community, they become a problem. Third, this is basic need. For mental prayer, it is wise to choose someone, either mystery of the faith, or you won't expect this, mystery in my own life. The word mystery has two very different meanings. There are mysteries that God has revealed, that because they are mysteries, they cannot be fully understood. There are mysteries in each one of our lives. The mystery of my own personality, the mystery of the people that God sends into my life, the mystery of a trial that I want to believe it's from God, and there's no way I can fully understand it. But there's also no question that I have to live with it. And in my estimation, the hardest mysteries to live with are not the mysteries of faith, but the mysteries in our own lives. They are also mysteries of faith, but we don't identify them with the Trinity or the hypostatic union. It's the mystery of, Lord, I don't understand why of all people this person should have entered my life. Or of all jobs or positions to be given, why this?
Excuse me, Father, I just would like to clarify something if you would. When you're speaking about contemplation in this particular sense, you're talking about it in its method sense, not in its general sense, correct? The reason I say that is because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking in terms of, see, some people would say, as you just said, you know, some people are called contemplative prayer, some people are not. And the reason I say that is that I think religious life, for instance, in its nature is contemplative. And if people don't look at it and as what I feel you're coming across as, they're going to say, well, then, you know...
Yes. In other words, what I am talking about now, because we are talking about the how. There are... This is a semester course which is very useful on contemplation. So we are not now analyzing contemplation in general, where the generic term contemplation, or the contemplative dimension as it's called, of the spiritual life is of the essence of religious life. Anything having to do with man's relationship to God can legitimately be called contemplative, as distinctive from the active or the apostolic, which has to do with my relationship either to myself or more commonly with my neighbor. That is not the sense in which I'm using the term here. So, in order to engage in formal mental prayer, no spiritual master omits stressing the importance of being specific. Now, sometimes, depending on, say, the trial in my life, I don't have to go into any kind of, planned efforts. I don't have to read a book of meditations to know what I'm going to meditate on during, say, this period of formal prayer. I can't get it off my mind. But even there may be a cluster of problems on my mind. And it is great wisdom to tell the Lord, Lord, I've got, as far as I can tell, 6 major problems, 6 mysteries in my life. I could, of course, just for the next half hour, complain to you or pity myself. I think you will be more pleased if I choose one of those 6. And you may not be in the mood to choose among these problems in your life. Nevertheless, select one, concentrate on that during the period of mental prayer, and watch this. The most important single grace of mental prayer is light for the mind. I repeat, the most important single grace which is to be the fruit of mental prayer is light for the mind. Some people jump to the affective side, tell God how much they love Him, and He never tires hearing. Have you tell Him, my God, I love you. But He might well remind us, if you love me, keep my commandments. And in all of our lives, it is doing God's will that is the source of our trials in life. And on the level of doing God's will, it is not so much, surely not for religious, the whether I should do God's will, or in what is God's will. That's the problem. I know God's will all too well. The problem is how. And for that I need light. In other words, by concentrating on some one mystery, and I think the word mystery spans all contingencies, whether it can be, and for many people, this is what they prefer. Read a passage in the scriptures, without me you can do nothing, which is the mystery of the necessity of grace. And they can just lose themselves in that. For others, it is the mystery of daily living. It is still wise to be more specific than generic. Then, in terms of basic need, what I call the attitude of prayer, what I've also called the when of prayer. When, as you remember, say in Matthew's Gospel, the disciples came to Jesus and asked Him, Lord, teach us to pray. His answer was, when you pray, say. And then He gave us the Lord's Prayer. There should be, in every person's life, the whens of prayer. In other words, that I somehow cut myself off. I do something, but I better do something which will put aside, for the time being, other laudable interests, even grave concerns, and now I'm going to pray. placing oneself, as the expression goes, into the presence of God is, I don't want to say the most basic need, but one of the most important practices when we begin prayer. Know that you've started praying, that you're no longer doing whatever you were doing before. Do something dramatic. I think I told you Ignatius tells his disciples to, first of all, make an act of the presence of God. Lord, grant that all the actions, operations, and intentions of this spiritual exercise may tend solely to the praise and glory of your name, or some equivalent. Then to perform some physical action. You're in your room, you close the door. You become quiet. As I think I told you, what I do is genuflect on both knees and kiss the ground. I'm telling you this, though I've tried to make sure that nobody sees me doing this. You make an act of the presence of God. You may have seen pictures of Muslims during their five times a day, making their, well, obeisance towards Allah. Bowing, hands outstretched. Do something when you begin to pray.
Whenever I see Pope John Paul do that, as he goes into a country, I think to myself, he must have that practice that you have. Because I don't think you could do it on occasion. He's used to doing it,
I'm sure.
That must be a practice.
And once it gets into a person's system, it becomes habitual. In other words, what I'm doing, see, when I genuflect or kiss the ground, I am externalizing what should be an internal kneeling and act of adoration. And we are at peace. Our body is connected, to say the least, with our soul. Brother?
I was going to say, Father, just one thing really, that speaking, I suppose, really from my very brief, really, experience, and would you not say that when you go into prayer, just to tell the Lord, look, your problems, and like, sort of, do this on a rather continual basis, it can be a sort of licking your wounds, as it were, before the Lord.
On that level,
do you
frankly,
understand what I'm trying to say?
Well, I think I
and
do.
And that isn't prayer.
Well, this is, well, of course, I would have to say, what's wrong with licking your wounds before the Lord? First of all, I've got wounds. And he knows me, how well he knows me.
Sure.
And so the essence of prayer is not informing God. He already knows. The essence of prayer, the metaphysical essence of prayer, is total submission of the human spirit before the Almighty. And God doesn't need our prayer, but we do. In other words, there's only one congenital disease that we all have, and that is pride. And what prayer is, or it should be, what prayer is and should be, is a concentrated awareness of a fact of my existence. Now, there is nothing, for example, that cannot be abused. I guess it's possible to drink too much water. I know it's possible to wash your hands too often. I've seen people washing their hands, at least I've heard about it, not a dozen, but 20 or more times a day. So I'm sure. I've seen people, after they licked a stamp and put it on the envelope, then they press, then they pound it. So there is nothing, you're right, brother, there is nothing that cannot get out of hand, including these acts of subordination.
But what I would want to say, you know, really, it's something you really, for those in formation, you need to, like, guard the young religious against it.
Well, maybe, I suppose you do, but now, I am not in charge of formation as such. I'm not quite sure what my role is here. I hope I'm being of some assistance. But I dare say most people nowadays, and that would include those entering religious life, otherwise good Catholics, are so involved and immersed in the secular world that what we're talking about here, I don't think would be too much for them. And if some of the guests slightly out of hand, well, all right. A certain amount of excess, if we're going to exceed it anything, let it be in spiritual matters. I must say that as one who does know, however, a lot of young religious, in a given month, I guess, I teach about 200 of them. And I have access to the consciences of most of them. So I don't think it's a great problem. I think the principle behind it is so valuable that for failure to do this, I think a lot of people, even after years in the religious life, you can hardly tell, they hardly know when they're praying. You do something even dramatic to emphasize it. And this might have to be somewhat changed periodically in order to emphasize the fact that I am now praying. Sister, did you have?
Yeah. I was going to say, really, a person cannot come to say, you know, my God, I love you, and I need, until the mind is at peace. If we have problems, it seems to me we have to take care of them with the Lord.
Otherwise,
the only one who can help us.
In other words, God wants us
to be at peace
as we are, and if we are in trouble, he wants us to talk about that trouble and pour the trouble out. First of all, it's even good psychology, not to say good theology. And we come into the presence, for example, I had a conference with Archbishop Loggi, the Apostolic Delegate, last Monday. Well, you just spontaneously, and I noticed he didn't withdraw his hand as other bishops do. And there were other people with me, and I noticed, and some of them are not used to doing this, but I genuflected, kissed his finger, that is the ring on his finger, and the others followed suit. So what's wrong with doing that?
I think that where so many of us make a mistake is that when we go into prayer, we do take our problems to God, but we keep the solution to ourselves and we don't really refer them to him. So it's just a time in being in chapel where we're just ruminating everything that's going on and not referring it to God. And then we have lost, I think maybe that's what Brother's saying.
Yeah.
We've lost the time of prayer. We haven't really put ourselves in the presence of God. We really haven't asked his help. We've just told him everything that's wrong with the world. And we really haven't told him. We've just reminded ourselves.
Yes, this is, and it's, well, you've got to make a will act to really, and there's a difference. A person, people have admitted to me, they have spent, for example, a liturgical exercise, an hour, hour and a half, and only after the whole thing is over do they realize, my gosh, I was in the presence of Christ. Come into chapel, and again there, to get into the habit of doing something concrete, something definite, because our whole preoccupation is not towards God. And this, by the way, remember, Pope John Paul in his latest encyclical, in the need for conversion, turning towards God. Our natural tendency is to turn towards self.
Yeah.
That's
so it takes an effort. All I know is that I've got to keep making it, and I have no illusions about being a mystic. I tell people I still have to have my first ecstasy. So, now, concentration. Everybody talks about it. What do? Well, there are three things, this is now during prayer, that we should concentrate on. We're talking about mental prayer. There is first concentrating with our knowledge, or better, concentrating with our minds on certain knowledge. Secondly, there's concentration of the will through love. And there is thirdly, concentration of the whole being in service. Now those three words, knowledge, love, and service, are not just the classic triad of all good spiritual living. They are the three-part formula for good prayer. I've got to keep my mind concentrated. And if I don't, nothing else will follow. But mere concentration of mind through knowledge, not having distractions, as the expression goes, doesn't necessarily mean good prayer. Now, this is the hard one. I'm not even sure I'll be clear in explaining it. There's a concentration in love. Does that make sense? And it's not exactly not having distractions. Now, one of the most practical post-conciliar documents, which most people hardly know exists, is the Handbook on Indulgences, which I think I asked you, didn't I, to prepare for a quiz on the indulgences for today, which you will be happily given. This Handbook on Indulgences describes what an indulgence is, the difference between plenary and partial, how you gain each. But one thing that touches immediately on this concentration of love, you gain a plenary indulgence only if you are totally detached from all sinful creatures. Or, put otherwise, you can gain a plenary indulgence only when your love is so exclusively on God that you are indifferent to all other creatures, and you would not pause for a moment, even for the smallest creature, if you knew it was not pleasing to God. So this concentration in love is real. There are only two loves to which the human heart, shall I say, is subject, and they are the love of God and the love of creatures. And of course, the loveliest of creatures is also the nearest of creatures, and we all know who that is. And then, concentration in service. This is why it is not only possible, but highly recommended, would go much beyond my intended scope in this coverage. There is such a thing as praying mentally always. Where there is the concentration of my service, that I give myself entirely to what I know is God's will, and I'm doing it because He wants it. Now, in terms of actual practice of mental prayer, I believe for most people, mental prayer is best practiced in terms of what I call sensed needs. I've got five here, but they could be multiplied times 10. Trials of every kind, especially those where there is no identifiable human cause, second, sufferings, which I distinguish from trials by identifying sufferings with a known created cause, third, temptations from the world, the flesh, and the evil spirits. The world is the people around me, and they can be very good people, but good people can be a temptation. For example, spending more time with them than with others who are not so pleasing. The flesh, another word for flesh is myself. We are the principal source of our own temptation. And the evil spirits, especially those unexplainable temptations, which can be put down to the evil spirits. Problems of any kind and fifth, desires. They can be desires for the things of God. They can be desires that are, we believe, or we hope at least, willed by God. And on each one of these, and I've read enough of the life of the mystics, women like Teresa, men like John of the Cross, to know that a great deal of the mental prayer, even of the highest reaches of sanctity, is a fruit of a felt or sensed need. Any time a person feels that they've made it, they've got it, they have, in my estimation, stopped praying. Sister?
I think so often of Peter on Tabor, because it seems that on occasion when I will, all at once, I have realized that I've been praying, and you know, and it's so nice. As soon as that thought comes to me, I can prepare to fall asleep or distract or something. At the minute that comes to me,
yeah.
How nice it is to be here, immediately.
Well, that's, but this is so real. Prayer is the most down-to-earth enterprise in which we are engaged under heaven. Now, something about stages in mental prayer, which I think people entering religious life and even sometimes the veterans need to be instructed on. The traditional three stages we are all familiar with, purification, illumination, and union. What value is there in that distinction? How seriously should it be taken? And some warnings about how it should not be understood. The division goes back to the early patristic age. As I recall, Ambrose, that's the late 3rd and early, pardon me, late 4th, early 5th centuries. There is a biblical foundation for it, that God purifies those who wants to enlighten, and the prelude to his union is illumination. So, this is true, it's in Isaiah, it is on in St. John, quoting our Lord, for example, in the 4th Gospel. There is a certain, but I qualify, there is a certain sequence in what is called progress in prayer. A book that I would recommend to you, and it almost suggests that it become a textbook in your lives, and I just hope the book is still in print. Edward Lean, Progress Through Mental Prayer. How many of you are familiar with it? One of the 12 great books of my life, always outside the scriptures. Not always simple reading, but profound and eminently practical. So there is such a thing as progress. And what is valid about this triad? What is valid is that there is no progress in mental prayer without purification. That means trial, that means suffering, that means temptation. Or what I call the three T's, trial, temptation, and tribulation. What can be mistaken, however, and I've dealt with enough souls to know that people can be mistaken, is to suppose there comes a point, and every one of us hopes it comes early, that the stage of purification will have ceased. And I am now graduated from grammar school. I'm in high school. As though the elementary grades correspond to purification, high school corresponds to illumination, and I'm in college now. I'm in the state of union. Well, needless to say, that purification continues through life. Why? Because those whom God purifies, he purifies still more. He keeps purifying.
I think that that's why the young people get so discouraged sometimes. They have the idea that something's going to happen and all at once it's going to be easy.
Yeah. At any rate, that's the first regarding purification. Illumination. What is true about illumination coming after purification? That God reserves his graces of light only for the pure of heart. There's a whole beatitude on that subject. And I cannot tell you how saddened I was. I think it's here. No? Could somebody find the New American Bible, please? I would almost ask you to make at least an implicit intention in your prayers that the New American Bible be revised soon. I cannot tell you how poorly it is done. At any rate, let's just take in Matthew's Gospel the 5th chapter, 8th verse. This is, of course, the Beatitudes in which Christ says, "Blessed are the clean of heart, for they shall see God," which for our purpose declares, "Blessed are those who are pure, for they shall see God." Or, "Blessed are those who are purified." The road to humility is humiliation. The road to purity is purification. And while the immediate focus of this cleanness of heart is chastity, it covers the whole spectrum of cleanness of heart, which can be, as we know, stained with only one thing, and that is sinful attachment to creatures. When Sister brings, if she finds a copy of the New American Bible, we will quote the new version of that Beatitude. So, illumination normally follows. God gives His light to those who are detached from creatures. And detachment comes through suffering. God causes us suffering through creatures in order to detach us, otherwise known as in order to purify us. What is not precisely true, it would not be true to say that once purified, we are now enlightened, and we've made it. This, in fact, was the heresy of the Gnostics, otherwise known as the heresy of the Knowers. They thought they knew it. And this is a real danger in the spiritual life. This, too, must be an ongoing process. Not only does God continue to purify us during life, but a precondition for being more and more enlightened is being more and more purified.
Thank you.
We must continue to suffer and sacrifice in order to become more and more enlightened. And we don't have to stay up nights trying to figure out, now what can I suffer next?
Father, we had a superior at one time, and I think Sister Mary Delco had a terrific saying. She said we should be happy when we fall, in that we find out what we are and what we have been all along.
Yes.
It goes on forever. We have
yes.
So many things we have never been tested.
That's St. Paul glorying in his infirmities. Mm-hmm. And those were not just infirmities of body, they were mainly infirmities of soul. Look, here is the New American Bible version. "Blessed are the single-hearted, for they shall see God." That's not the Greek. It's not the word of Revelation. Single-hearted, well, you can put almost any kind of meaning into it. Blessed are the pure of heart, the clean of heart, those whom God has purified in the crucible of tribulation.
Father, I read an explanation of that once. It said that if you're single-hearted, then you seek only God, and therefore you are pure of heart, or you would be clean of heart. So it kind of boils down to that.
Well, that,
why they don't see it in the
that could be, brother.
Well, I was going to say, Father, might I not be singularly, you know, have an undivided attention on the devil, and it has nothing to do with God, and I'm single-hearted.
Yes. But also the idea, in other words, of being cleansed and purified is missing. This is something that God has a vested interest in. He keeps cleansing us, keeps purifying us. At any rate, it is in the process of being translated, retranslated, but we just hope the next version will be an improvement on this one. Then, regarding union as a stage, what is emphatically true? It is emphatically true that the state of union in prayer, which is infused contemplation, that, by the way, is a good synonym for the stage of union, infused contemplation, that is not something that just comes without effort on our part. We must first be purified, secondly, enlightened, and in order to be enlightened, I must make an effort to learn. I must meditate. I must engage in mental prayer in order that I might merit the grace of union. What would not be true? It would not be true that once I've reached, say, the stage of infused contemplation, I can relax. Oh, no, I can't. In fact, there is no one in greater danger of falling than the mystic, because they can become proud, and there's no worse pride than spiritual pride. Now, something about different personalities. I think in dealing with people whom I wish to train in the practice of prayer in general and mental prayer in particular, it makes quite a difference for me to recognize the kind of person I'm dealing with. And I think the four classic personalities are as useful as any classification: the melancholic, the lethargic, the choleric, and the sanguine. Just a word about how I would help one in each of these types to cultivate the spirit of prayer. The melancholic, who is given to reflection, meditation, has the danger of brooding. This type of person might spontaneously desire mental prayer and may find it relatively easy. The danger with such persons is that, as I think someone mentioned before, that when I'm praying regarding my trials or difficulties or needs, I can be so preoccupied with the problem that I forget that I'm supposed to be praying. So with that first type, the meditative type, two things are to be watched for. One, not to be lost in the problem or the need and exclude the presence of God to whom my prayer should be addressed. And secondly, there is the danger of its making my prayer analytic, speculative, subtle, so discursive that it is less prayer than perhaps mental gymnastics, even though the object of my prayer is God. What's the remedy? I think the main remedy is to keep God on my mind and in my heart when I pray with that first type of personality. Secondly, the lethargic. I think the lethargic person, who by definition is the lazy person, who tends to relax and remain at rest when there should be movement, should be and trained to becoming disciplined in their mental prayer. Have something definite to pray about, get going, and keep going. I found persons who have just read a book on the prayer of quiet, the prayer of simplicity. Are there such prayers? Yes. But with some people, what the theologians call the prayer of quiet is another form of sleep. They're just not active. Now here you've got to deal with different people. If it's the lazy type of person, and remember, the worst kind of laziness is mental laziness, spiritual laziness. Be sure you're dealing with a lethargic person, and with that person, I think mental prayer means especially spiritual effort. St. Thomas says, in fact, he defines sloth as the unwillingness or reluctance to exert oneself in spiritual matters. After 40 years in the religious life, some people have not cultivated the spirit of prayer because they are spiritually lazy. Third, the choleric type, brother.
Father, going back to the lethargic type person, can we safely infer that they're lethargic by judging external actions?
No. On the other hand, since the essence of prayer is to change our lives, that's, if it doesn't do that, my prayer is not successful. If a person's external behavior is evidently lethargic, otherwise known as lazy, then even though they may be exerting themselves in prayer, maybe they're not exerting themselves enough otherwise. And this is Ignatius' phrase, all power in the spiritual life flows from the interior. All power in the spiritual life flows from the interior. There is something lacking in their life of prayer if they are even externally lazy. Now the choleric. The choleric, as you know, is the naturally and spontaneously irascible. It's the impatient type. There are a lot of things that this type of personality needs to be taught regarding prayer. They must be taught, and they may be embarrassed to be told this. All impatience with people is impatience with God. I repeat, all impatience with people is impatience with God. And therefore, this type of person should first of all be told that what they need especially is the profoundest humility before God. Now, we're all given to pride, But my norm for a person's tendency towards pride is their giving in to impatience. Again, this type of person, given to impatience or anger, must at all costs subdue this passion. Otherwise, and this touches on the essence of the spiritual life, otherwise God will not show his mercy in visiting the soul with his graces of prayer, unless the individual shows mercy towards others. And no one, but no one, grows in prayer without a lot of grace from God. If you want to grow in prayer, you must at all costs practice that mercy, which is the opposite of being irascible. Otherwise, you may wonder, after all the books you've read and all the efforts you expend, why you are not more prayerful. This can be told to the irascible choleric type. Finally, in terms of progress in mental prayer, the choleric type of personality must be patient with himself. That there is such a thing as growing in the spiritual life, here progressing in prayer, not because I'm not trying hard enough, but because God does not want me to become advanced in prayer without going through the steps. I'm told, and I guess it's true, that youngsters like to play as adults. Isn't it true that girls like to put on their mother's gown, and I've seen little girls with their mother's hats on? One of the hardest things to get over is role-playing. As children, we want to be adults. And when we grow up, we like to play that we're still young. The $7 billion cosmetic industry is role-playing. What's true in nature is also true in the area of grace. It just takes time. The choleric must be patient with God. And finally, the sanguine. These are the natural optimists. These are the persons who, when they hear about people's trials and tribulations, may see a prayer of commiseration, but for the life of them, they don't know what all this fuss is about. Trials and tribulations, I guess I have mine, but everything is rosy. The people who are always seeing the good side, which is beautiful, but they never see what's wrong, either in them or in others. Now they have a problem. The problem is that, if I said earlier, sense needs of the normal nourishment of mental prayer, they better become more aware than some of them are of the needs they have in order to want to pray, because they believe they need God. Now, one thing that I found in dealing with people of this temperament And it's good to try to size them up as soon as possible. Don't tell them you've sized them up. It spoils it all. What I found is there is a peculiar selectivity in the optimism of the most sanguine personality. It's remarkable how optimistic and casual and live and let live character they can have about certain things. But about other things, where they have real needs, they are not even aware of them. They need to be reminded of some real needs they have to alert them to the need for communing with God and getting His help. I suppose in each case a certain type of prayer predominates. May I just suggest with this close, with a melancholic, the kind of prayer that this type of personality finds most congenial is meditation on the cross. Beautiful. The lethargic. They will find meditation or even contemplation on the mercy of God, on God's bounty and His generosity, most congenial. The choleric. Oh, that's easy. Divine justice. And some of their favorite passages. You guessed it. Every time that Christ castigated the Pharisees and told them what He thought of them, they can spend hours in meditation. And they like especially John the Baptist calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers. Christ driving the money changers out of the temple. The 25th chapter of Matthew, when Christ tells those on His left hand, "Depart from me." You get the general picture. Symbolized, remember, by the sons of thunder and the sanguine. They can spend hours, and God so chooses such souls, in quiet, simple adoration before the divine majesty, unaffected by the confusion and the chaos all around them. And with this, I think we should stop. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.
Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death, amen. O Mary, conceived without sin, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Apologies for the extra time, but I just thought I should finish that. I believe our first area of coverage is the vows. Is that correct? What we have been doing normally. And we still have some more to say about the means of maintaining chastity. just to repeat certain things we may have seen and refresh our memories, that the first and most effective means of maintaining oneself in chastity is a close friendship with Christ and familiarity with God. And as I think we mentioned, in this world, no one lives without love. It all depends on whom we love. Since, by definition, consecrated chastity is the sacrifice of created love, you either cultivate a deeper love for God, or you either do not preserve your chastity, or at least will not grow in it. That is why I think we mentioned the last time that the practice of charity is an index of our growth in the virtue of chastity. I dare say among the virtues that we assume it's either keeping or breaking it, it's chastity, we seldom think of growing in this vow or virtue. How do you grow in the virtue of chastity? You grow in the virtue of chastity by your practice of charity, shown first and mainly by your growth in the love for God. As I've been telling you on this subject, I'm drawing on my own Jesuit sources. Let me read what's here. All should cultivate close friendship with Christ and familiarity with God, for in this world no one lives without love. When our contemporaries question or fail to understand what our love is, we should offer them a fitting reply through the witness of a life of consecrated chastity. People should know that we are deeply, profoundly in love. All I know is that the most, you might say, angular and misfit characters in the world are religious who have sacrificed marriage and have not fallen deeply in love with God. At the same time, realizing that we are human and weak, with humble and persevering prayer we should beg for ourselves and our fellow religious the grace of personal love for Christ. None is more important. The grace of personal love for Christ. So that Christ for me is not an abstraction or a generality, but a person. Among the great servants of God, they all experienced this grace. And it so permeated their lives, and we should ambition this, that this love bound the individual, it should bind us to our fellow religious first. Our first object of fraternal charity should be our fellow religious. And this is the mystery of chastity. You would think a person who sacrifices marital love and family life would become something of a weirdo, or eccentric, or, as the technical phrase goes, a misanthrope. But no. Our consecrated chastity, which is built on the personal love for Christ, makes us, and it should make us, personally very affable. As often as we have seen the word affable, the most exalted word in Latin for speaking is fore. This is to speak to. An affable person is one who can easily talk to others, and others can speak to him. Affability is talk to ability. Consecrated chastity, when lived as it should, develops a personal affability that will draw countless people through us to God. This is a grace we should often ask God for. In the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, he urged people to implore this grace. They should keep asking God to make Christ to them more real, more personal, even more sensibly perceptible, so that being deeply in love with Christ, they will be ready and willing to do everything for him, seeing how much he has done for me. That was all under number one in my source material. Again, chastity is to be grown in, and we therefore do not reach the full maturity or perfection of chastity in our early religious life. We are to keep it faithfully, but we are also to grow in it. The secret of growing in consecrated chastity is becoming more and more cleansed of creaturely affections, so that a person becomes more and more attached to God. Does growth in chastity exclude love for other human beings? Not only does it not exclude it, it requires it. I think I use the words that our love for others should grow in maturity, in simplicity, and in the absence of anxiety. Because to be able to deal easily with people, whether of the same or of the opposite sex, is indispensable for successful work in the apostolate. Once again, we're still on the level of means. If I want to grow in my consecrated chastity, I must make sure that I practice those means of austerity and self-denial, of asceticism and mortification, without which all the goodwill in the world to remain chaste will not succeed. I'm not sure how much time we spent the last time on exercising care and prudence in dealing with other people. All I can tell you is that imprudence here is very costly. Any questions before we go on? I would like to say something about the role of superiors. First of all, admission to the religious life should be conditioned on a number of factors. One, and a very important one, is that a person should be considered suited for a life of concentrated and consecrated chastity. It should be clear that the ones who enter religious life enter with complete freedom, that they are suited morally, physically, and psychologically, that they are free from such tendencies, and I quote, which might have been transmitted from their family. This does not mean necessarily a genetic weakness, but a weakness that was not precisely inherited, but acquired through family living that may have weakened one's ability to resist temptations to chastity. Now, with the instability of American society, we're having more and more people entering religious life from broken homes. Can a young man or woman from a broken home become a good religious? Yes. Is it harder for a person from a broken home to maintain their consecrated chastity? Yes. Because a balanced relationship with persons of the opposite sex has a lot to do with the kind of relationship their son or daughter had with their father and mother. On the daughter's side, the relationship with their father. On the son's side, the relationship with his mother. These are basic psychic laws. Again, and I'm reading from the directives given to the Society of Jesus. Since the observance of total continence involves the deeper inclinations of human nature, candidates should not undertake the profession of chastity. This is, to take even their first vows, nor be admitted to its profession except after a truly adequate testing period, and only if they have the needed degree of psychological and emotional maturity. All I know is that the vows don't work a miracle. Proof of this is to be found particularly in a certain stability of spirit in an ability to make considered decisions, people who are forever changing their minds, and in an accurate manner of passing judgment on events and people, equilibrium of character is necessary for living a life of consecrated chastity. And as a priest, after 30 and more years of dealing with consecrated souls, I know that difficulties and problems that one type of personality can take with God's grace, another finds very difficult. The surest way in which some people's insecurity, instability, anxiety, and worry are manifest is in having strong rising of the passions, and they've got problems with chastity. Again, regarding superiors, the first that we've just described I did that once when I was a college student. I was at a party and I was serving piping hot coffee. In my distraction, I poured it over a girl's head. Years later, I was reminded of that as a Jesuit. We are talking about the vow of chastity, its means of preservation, and we are concentrating in our last reflections on this, on the responsibilities of superiors. And we've just explained how superiors have a duty to make sure that those who are admitted are qualified, and that before they take their vows, especially their final vows, that they show that kind of character stability without which the maintenance of chastity can be very difficult. Again, those in charge of religious should see to it that religious, in the course of their formation, are educated in the matter of sex in a suitable, positive, and prudent manner. Suitable, positive, and prudent manner. Why? So that religious may properly know and esteem, now watch this, not only the meaning and superiority of consecrated chastity, but also something about the duties and the dignity of Christian marriage. Otherwise, a number of things can happen. After some years in the religious life, a person may, not having in this positive, suitable, and prudent way learned about marriage, may be drawn to that life which was supposedly sacrificed and find it very difficult to remain in celibacy. Also, whatever else a religious consecrated to chastity should not be, he or she should not be a cop-out from marriage. Because the very things that a person is seeking to escape from marriage, responsibility. Hardship. Living with other people. Are the very things that that same individual will find in a community. As a religious, we've got to live with other people. And needless to say, we're going to find all kinds of difficulties. And above all, the responsibility, in other words, a religious does not give up his or her own thinking and deciding. Moreover, now, how to put this will depend, of course, on the individual. But there is such a thing as being armed in advance, and this is through the early years of formation, so as to be able vigorously to surmount the certain crises affecting chastity that will arise in one's religious life. Now, this is where prudence is essential. This does not mean a 3-year course in sex education to the young religious. It does mean that religious, and just because they know a lot about, quote, sex before they enter the community, doesn't mean they know a great deal about marriage or the sexual life. Certain things that, for example, as a religious, I should expect because I'm a human being, that my passions don't die out. And that the chastity that some people have to practice is the chastity of militant conflict for years. And the best example that comes to my mind is Aloysius Gonzaga, who died, as you know, in his 20s, eventually canonized, but who had just powerful passions. So that the passionless person is not, needless to say, the one who most certainly has a vocation. Struggle, conflict. But how do you cope with it? But also how you can avoid it. And I would here say especially, now let me be clear, no religious except in certain orders where the church has approved it. The Society of Jesus is one exception. No superior may coerce in sense of demanding either by psychology or less ill by some kind of physical compulsion that the religious under their care manifest their conscience. That I trust you know. No coercion or compulsion may be used. You might see that stands to reason. But that emphatically does not mean that those in charge, whether in the early years of formation or superiors, do not know those in their religious community. Manifesting one's conscience is of the essence of being a good religious. Now for some people, maybe for women more than for men, it is hard and maybe hardest to manifest one's conscience in this matter of chastity. All I'm saying is that there must be someone in authority in the church, either superior or confessor, who knows your conscience in this matter of chastity. I know of no device or weapon in the devil's armory that is more dangerous than being secretive on this matter of chastity in dealing with people who have a right to know. Am I clear? Someone has to know. I'm not suggesting the person next door or somebody you call up on the telephone. But those who have authority in the church, the confessor, and or the superior. In the society of Jesus, our superiors have a right, and we have a duty to manifest our conscience. And we sin if we don't. The church's general law is the manifestation of conscience should be made. It may not be in any way coerced. It is wise, and I recommend this, in dealing with superiors and communities, I recommend that early in the religious life they request and make it as gentle as possible, request that the person entering the community at their leisure and at their convenience, and make sure that it's plain to the one to whom they are giving this directive, that there is no compulsion of any kind, to tell as much as they are free to say about their past life. Of course, on the part of the one who receives this confidential information, this must be kept confidential, and just so you've heard it. And that kind of confidence, which is put in writing and given to a person in charge of formation and or the superior, if the one so wishes to manifest him or herself, may not be shared with anyone, and let me make it clear, under pain of mortal sin. It may never, unless the person says you may do it, and insofar as the person gives you permission. Okay? And if it's given to a person in charge of formation, it may not be shared with the superior, unless and insofar as the one who makes the manifestation gives permission. Is that clear? I say that just to ensure confidentiality. But I know how well I know human nature, because I've lived with this creature for so many years, and I deal with so many souls. Openness in the matter of chastity is for most people the divinely prescribed precondition for the grace to remain chaste. All right? Any questions? We're still on the subject of superiors. Exercising due firmness and putting aside a kindness which might better be called cruelty, they should take care that those who are unfit or doubtfully suitable be not advanced to vows. Right?
Father, you said doubtfully suitable. In other words, there must be moral certainty.
And if there's any room for discussion about poverty and obedience, there should be no room regarding chastity. But notice, the precondition here is that the person is open. Because if the individual is not open, how can you tell? Now, to exemplify, suppose someone so lives separated from others in the community that he or she raises a positive doubt about their aptitude for ready companionship with their fellow villagers or for apostolic dealings with others. That person, and this is a law in the Society of Jesus I share with you, that person should be directed to some other way of serving God. The two words I hope you will never forget that belong together by divine mandate are chastity and charity.
Father, could you repeat that again, please, the first part of that statement?
For example, someone who so lives separated from the others in the community that he or she raises a positive doubt about their aptitude for ready companionship with their fellow villagers or for apostolic relationship with their neighbor, that person should be directed to some other way of serving God. If only this law had been better observed in my own society and in other religious institutes, we would have spared ourselves the spectacle of a loss of 60,000 villagers in the United States since the Council. The principal concrete reason, practical reason, for the loss of vocation is chastity. The principal reason for most people having trouble with chastity is their failure in charity. And here we all have a responsibility for our fellow religious. They should not be called upon to practice heroic charity because I am not practicing even basic Christian charity. In other words, I cannot place heroic demands on others and expect them to remain chaste because their charity is so difficult to practice because of the lack of charity on the part of others in the community. I would like to add one more thing. In our times, those who hold fast to a firm doubt regarding the value and worth of the vow of chastity are not to be judged fit for religious life. Am I clear? Anyone, this is now a theoretical question. The previous one is a practical question. There are a lot of strange ideas roaming around these days. Some maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I had occasion to go through the stockpile of books at the Thomas More bookshop in the Loop to find out what books by then, let's make it 10 years ago, were currently in print on the religious life or some aspect of it. It may seem strange, but I counted 40 titles. Many of those books, I didn't read them all, many of those books cast doubt on the value of consecrated chastity. All I can say is that people who have any kind of real doubt about the value and meaning of chastity, it's going to plague them later on, even if they are themselves resolved to remain chaste. Brother?
Father, I think that's so profound, particularly today, when in religious, when the theology of religious life in many, many instances, secularized theology emphasizes the decommunity, you know, the lack of community. In other words, they emphasize so much the individual that they...
Oh, brother, this is so true. Which makes chastity practically impossible. And there's no single place that I would warn, I don't think there's another verb I can use, warn religious not to read certain types of literature. These are books, these are pamphlets, these are articles in magazines, for example. You simply cannot read all the articles in Review for Religious. You can't. And not become mixed up on the practice of the vows, including chastity. And sisters, today, I'll be stronger. How often?